Elizabeth Barrett is a wife, mother, grandmother, licensed marriage and family therapist, educator, eavesdropper, and emotion worker. She uses all of these skills to address the subjects that we all struggle with in this conversation with a reluctant therapist.
Happy Tuesday. I have a guest in the studio with me today that we have a lot to talk about. Matter of fact, it took all of our self-control to not have the whole conversation before we started off today. So I'm going to jump in and introduce my guest, Dr. Stephen Lloyd Moffitt. He is a professor of religious studies at Cal Poly, and we've been on the show together a couple of times talking about religion. As every time I see you, I say the same thing. I could have a conversation about religion probably once a month because I find it so fascinating. But we're not trying to overdo it. We're trying to spread it out. But today, you're here because you have written a book called The Spirit of Wine, Finding Religion in the Fruit of the Vine. And I can't think of anything more appropriate to have a conversation about here than wine as some sort of spiritual practice. But also not just wine itself, which is the book, but part of what you and I talked about before was that for a lot of people, traditional religious institutions aren't really calling to them, or they have changed in such a way that they aren't drawing the same numbers of people. But there is still that spiritual yearning that people have, looking for something deeper and more meaningful. And so what are some of those alternative paths that people are finding that fill kind of that spiritual void? Things like hiking or surfing or ceramics or time with animals, whatever that can be. And in our last couple of conversations, I think we danced around this a little bit about the idea, can you actually call hiking or ceramics a spiritual practice? Because it seems that to truly have faith, there has to be some tie to the institutionalized or traditional pieces of religion. So we're going to talk about the new book. We're going to talk about wine in general, because I know that you are a wine aficionado as well. I'm going to just read your introduction on the back of your book to kind of give some context. Dr. Stephen Lloyd Moffitt is a professor of religious studies at Cal Poly, San Luis Obispo. He's an amateur winemaker and caretaker of a backyard vineyard. He holds a Master of Arts and PhD in religious studies from University of California, Santa Barbara, as well as a Master of Theology from St. Vladimir's Orthodox Theological Seminary. His past research includes studies on comparative mysticism, the origins of Christianity, and the cognitive science behind religious experience. And he knows that I skipped a word because I didn't know how to pronounce it.
Elizabeth, thanks for having me on, and thanks for all you do in the community and to expand our minds, not just on religion, spirituality, but throughout all the things going on in our lives.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And this isn't an area that I know anything about. I'm not a wine aficionado by any means, so I'm looking forward to being educated. I love having a professor in because you have that professor voice that I just want to listen to. So we'll see where it takes us. And we will be opening up the phone lines for your questions or comments later on in the program. Our number is 805-781-3875 if you have something you'd like to ask Dr. Lloyd Moffitt or contribute to the conversation. And also you can be part of the conversation by sending me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. And if you follow us on Instagram or Facebook, you can get updates about shows that are coming or links to previous shows. And if you'd like to really stay connected to the show, you can subscribe to our podcast by visiting Apple Podcasts or NPR Podcasts, however you find your shows. Look for a conversation with a reluctant therapist. It's a lot to type. When it pops up, hit subscribe, and then the shows will be available to you, for you, at your convenience. And then you can also listen to the last 10 years of programs by visiting kcbx.org and look under the news talk tab and find the show, and they're all there. And just a side note of the Instagram, because Stephen and I were talking about it before the show, neither one of us are huge social media people, but it's such a great way to kind of quickly catch up with all the things that are happening. Anyone who's promoting an activity or a book or an event, Instagram seems to be the go-to these days. And ours is Elizabeth_TRT. So that is there for you to follow and get more information. All right. So let's jump into it. Why this book? What inspired you to write something that would, on the surface, seem to be not really an academic pursuit?
Yeah, I mean, it was not something that I had planned. I mean, if you would have asked me in my career, would I end up writing a wine book, that was not on my horizon at all. And but I ended up teaching a class on the history of wine and religion. I needed a couple of units. And I thought it was going to be largely a historical look, looking backwards, because this course with monks and Dionysius, there's a lot to work with there. But as I, you know, have spent my life looking at religious people, I began to look at the people around me, people in my department, people who I met at wine events. And I said, these are some of the most devoted people I know, but their God is just not something that they traditionally call God. Their God is Pinot or Cabernet. But if you look at the role religion plays in people's lives, setting aside what you think should count as religion, mm-hmm. it's things like where you find community, where you allow mystery into your life, where you seek out transcendence, where you guide your ethical decisions. And for so many people, wine was playing this role in their life already. And so I began to write it on sabbatical and began to sort of look at this world of wine through the lens of religious studies. And it just kept coming back again and again. I would interview somebody. And they would tell me these stories. Let me give you an example of a local winemaker, John Alban, probably one of the greatest winemakers in the world, a treasure just in our backyard, almost single-handedly brought Rhone varietals to America and is one of the greatest winemakers in the world. He was telling me on one of the very first classes that he had plans to go to medical school, I believe, and he was in L.A. having dinner, and someone brought him a white wine. He had one taste of it, and he just knew his entire life was going to change. And that wine was a Viognier from the town of Condry in France, which is in the Rhone Valley there. And within a few months, he had moved to Condry and was convinced that this wine was going to change the world. And I heard that, and I was like, that's just a conversion story.
Yeah,
I mean, I have heard this so many times when God came into my heart and my whole life had changed. And I have, you know, conducted maybe 75 formal interviews for the book, and almost everyone can tell me a conversion story where they realize that their life would never be the same because of an experience with wine. And so many of my lenses from religious studies just kept coming to the fore as I was doing research for this book. And even I came to realize in my own life that there was a wine for me that was my conversion.
That was
life-changing. And it was, it was almost 12, 13 years ago now, but almost to the day, because it was the last Friday of winter quarter, mm-hmm. and my department decided that we were all going to go wine tasting together. We didn't know each other that well at that point. I'd only been there, I think, a year at that point. And it was a sunny Friday in March, and we went down to Santa Ynez, and we went to Beckman Winery, a wonderful winery in Santa Ynez. We had a Syrah, and boy, that was good. We had the next one, it was amazing. The next one, amazing. And then we had this one, and we all stopped and said, wow, I didn't realize wine could be like this. And it was absurdly expensive for us at the time. Mm-hmm. It was like something like $50 or something. But we bought a bottle, and we sat, and we had some really mediocre cheese and this wonderful bottle of wine. And looking back, that's when we gelled as friends. That's when we came to understand each other. And wine is what brought us together. And when you look at what religion has done throughout human history, it brings people together and allows them to communicate at a level that you don't communicate in our shallow everyday conversations. And so just as, you know, you go to church or synagogue or temple or something like that, and you know, a lot of times nothing very moving happens, but you keep going back, on the hope that every once in a while something moving happens.
The sermon will pop.
but also the connections that you feel with others. And so if you set aside what religion should be and just look at the functions religion plays in your life, I came to recognize that wine is playing that role in people's lives already.
Okay. before we dive too deep in, because one, what was the wine that you drank?
It was a Clone One Syrah from Beckman.
Okay.
Vineyards, 2005.
And then I understand, I've never had a conversion experience with wine, but how do you parse out the wine as a religious conversion or experience, and then what we talk about people who overindulge in wine, or they, yeah. you know, like how do you, I just want to get this over with, this yeah. conversation part, so we can go into the spiritual part. But I think a lot of people's first yeah. reaction is, well, good. So everyone who wants to be, you know, overindulge or has yeah. an alcohol issue is now going to say, it's my religion.
Yeah.
How do you separate that out first?
Well, I think in all religious forums, there are people for whom the pathway doesn't fit, okay. either genetically or their personal history or their communal history. You know, some people will have traumatic experiences within the Catholic Church. Stepping in there is post-traumatic syndrome for them, you okay. know? Mm-hmm. It's troubling. And so, first to say, wine is not for everybody. And if you have a genetic predisposition, a biological or family predisposition, if it can play a destructive role in your life, this is not for you.
This is not your spiritual path.
Yeah, this is not your spiritual path. And that's great. There are many, many wonderful things. And, I also have to say that there are so many people I know who are happy with traditional religious pathways. And that is wonderful. That is great. If you are, you link up to a tremendous history, some incredibly refined theology, beautiful architecture, communities that are rich and experienced and close with each other. And if that's working, that's wonderful for you. And I don't want to take you away from that. And, maybe wine can augment that in your life. Maybe you can contribute that to your existing primary spiritual pathway. But I'm not trying to suggest that that is not a healthy or wonderful path. And I think for many people it is. But there are also people for whom traditional spiritual paths have brought wounds into their life and trauma and drama. And I think for many of those people, they still have the same spiritual impulses, the desire for deep community, the desire for mystery, the desire for transcendence, the desire for an ethical guide, and they're looking for something. And I think for a lot of them, they see it as a sort of multiple choice test. I don't want Catholic and Protestant, but hey, maybe Orthodox okay, or maybe Buddhist meditation's okay. And they sort of think of the roster of choices being limited to what's found in an encyclopedia or something. And what I want to say is that there are actually maybe even more options available to you if you're willing to explore them. And for some of you, that might be wine.
And I love, as you were describing the beauty of the architecture, what draws people into, going into a beautiful religious temple, in my head I was also picturing all these beautiful wineries and vineyards and the architecture. Yeah. So I could see all of a sudden that connection is coming clear to me that there is any place that we find to be spiritual or sacred, going into a forest, if find that to be your spiritual path, that I understand that piece of some place that you move into awakens something inside of you that you're surprised to feel or surprised to recognize.
Yeah, and I think that's certainly fine. I mean, if you are in a vineyard in the middle of summer, there's an energy there. Mm-hmm. And especially, we have some of the most beautiful vineyards in the world here on the Central Coast. And if you're sitting there drinking a wine on a summer afternoon with someone you love, that's a spiritual experience. Mm-hmm. And, you might just say, oh, that's a nice day. And it is that too. But if you want it to be part of your spiritual life, you can make that part of your spiritual life.
Intentionality.
If you can bring some intentionality mm-hmm. to it and realize that, hey, if my closest friends are the people with whom I share wine with, mm-hmm. that's fine. That's my church. Mm-hmm. That's my synagogue. And these are the people who I open up to. These are the people who we explore who we are and how the world works. And if we can be aware of that, then wine can be a vehicle to appreciate so much of the mystery and grandeur of life. Because, you know, when you drink a wine, let's say we drink a wine, you know, from Burgundy and from the 1970s, I have an entree into this beautiful lineage of Burgundian wine. I have an entree into this hillside in Burgundy where it was created. I may not have been to Burgundy, but I can taste it in the wine. I may not even have been living in 1973, but I have some insight because the harvest and the year of growing in 1973 is imprinted into that wine. And so if I can bring some intentionality to that, if I can understand that, you know, okay, this was a wet year and the wine reflects that. This hillside was first farmed by the Cistercians. This hillside is full of rocks. It looks across this village. Wine becomes the talisman to understand an entire time and place. If you can bring intentionality to it, in the same way as if I read about St. Francis of Assisi, he transports me back to medieval Italy and into a world in which is different from mine, but I can find connections to. And so wine can play that role. And that's why I think wine is so much different. We don't age beer for the most part. Mm-hmm. We don't age chocolate. Only very rarely do we age tea or something like that, because there are, you know, there are some different vehicles that have sort of transcendent capabilities to it. But wine is nearly unique in the sense that we age it, and you know, wines can age for 100 years, and every bottle tells the story of its birth, where it was, when it was conceived, who brought it into this world. And that's a connection that is so hard to find in other areas.
If you're just tuning in, my guest is Dr. Stephen Lloyd Moffatt, and you can hear in his voice his passion for The Spirit of Wine, which is his book about finding religion in the fruit of the vine. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. And we're exploring those alternatives to traditional religions, or how we set an intentionality, how we create our spiritual connection to things, maybe not even just wine, but it could be hiking or surfing or ceramics or something that you find community within. Or a sense of connection to history or mysticism. And so I want to go to the historical piece, because the blood of Christ, nectar of the gods, you know, the way that wine has been referred to throughout history. Can you talk a little bit about its place in traditions?
Yeah, in so many religious traditions, it's a sign of blessing. And I think it's because there's something miraculous that happens in wine. You know, you take these grapes and they transform into something different. In fact, the old English word for yeast that you would add to wine is God is good.
Oh, really?
So put some God is good into it, and we have this miracle that happens before us. And so, in that sense, the blessing from God is this wine that became part of our day-to-day life. For most of human history, you couldn't drink water because of the disease that came with it. But the alcohol made it so that, you know, you could drink it. And so, you know, the average person in the ancient world drank about a bottle and a half of wine a day. It wasn't the same level of alcohol as we have now, but it was just part of your day-to-day life. There's a great quote about French civilization that, you know, if you take away wine, you lose the French civilization, because it is so a part of being French. The same that Greece came into civilization with the discovery of olive oil and wine. You know, you take these basic staples of life and learn to appreciate them in a way that I think it's for modern people, it's very hard to appreciate to the same degree, because we have a million different options, right? You know, it's not just olive oil. We have pistachio oil, walnut oil, canola oil. I mean, gosh, there's just so much out there. We live in such a period of a cornucopia of riches that it's just tremendous abundance now that we sort of lose sight. But especially in biblical times, the Bible almost always mentions wine as the sign of blessing. And, you know, when God does his whole reboot with Noah, first thing Noah does is plant a vineyard. But that story is also great because it also leads him to get drunk and create problems. And so there's always been that facet too, which is what we were talking about. One of the things that there's the end of the book speaks of spiritual drunkenness. And it's a very delicate topic because I think, you know, the instinct of some of my students is that's just sort of drunk. Like, you know, really drunk it's like buzzed or yes. something like that. But what I point out is spiritual drunkenness is not the amount you drink. It's the attitude with which you drink. If you drink with an attitude of gratitude and giving, that's the way to drink. And really, the monks provide that example. You know, I lived in monasteries for a year, and the monks drink a tremendous amount of wine. But they drink it with a different spirit than maybe what goes on at Cal Poly on a Friday night, right? It's a opportunity to share and be with each other. I love in the Dominican tradition, you drink wine with every meal, but you're never allowed to fill your own glass. So when your glass is empty, you just look to give to others. And so when wine can be a vehicle to show gratitude for what God has brought into our lives and giving, a way to share with others, that's when it becomes spiritual. And being spiritually drunk is not so much about how much you drink, but more the if you keep that attitude. And as with all gifts of God, they can be abused. I can get sick off the number of pistachios if you put a big enough bowl in front of me, I will eat them all. There's no problem with pistachios, there's no problems with me. And so, you learn pistachios are one of those things I can't have in the house because I'll eat them all. And the same with wine. For some people, wine is not a healthy vehicle. And for those people, you know, they'll find other ways to discover wonder and meaning and purpose in their life.
In some way, we're able to find excess in anything. It goes back to the abundance. Because in modern history, everything is available through just, you know, the click of a button to come to us. And what I'm hearing is, you know, in ancient parts of history, everything was a blessing. If you had meat or if you were able to have a harvest of some healthiness, then everything was a celebration. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. My guest is Dr. Stephen Lloyd Moffitt. We're talking about the spirit of wine and how it can become a spiritual practice of itself or unto itself. Our number is 805-781-3875. We'll be back to continue this conversation.
I lost myself on a cool, damp night. Gave myself in that misty light. Was hypnotized by strange delight under a lilac tree. I made wine from the lilac tree, put my heart in its recipe. It makes me see what I want to see, be what I want to be. When I think more than I want to think, do things I never should do. I drink much more than I ought to drink because it brings me back you.
Elizabeth Barrett. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. All right, Stephen, is there a moment in history that wine first emerges? You know, who is the alchemist that, do you know that?
Yeah, so there are, the ancient history is we know it's been made for about 8,000 years. And Pat McGovern is a professor at Pennsylvania, archaeologist of wine. It seems to have started in Georgia, in ancient Georgia. But what's fascinating to me is so many religious traditions have myths about the origin.
Okay.
And they're almost always a happy discovery. They're you know, it's an accidental discovery, because if you just put grapes in a container,
right,
you have everything you need in that. It has sugar, it has yeast on the grapes. And so it theoretically could have been a happy accident. But it's one of the most ancient agricultural products we have, and one of the first things we know that humans figured out how to make.
Was it out of necessity? Because were people making a connection that the water was befouled and they needed? Someone realize that? And in the biblical story of turning water into wine, does that predate?
So, I mean, I think it was out of necessity, or at least they learned that people got sick less. But you know, if you look at that biblical story, so if you know your story of Jesus's life, you know, the story is Jesus is with his mother at a wedding at Cana, and they serve wine. And at the end of the night, they run out of wine. And this is such a social faux pas that Jesus' mother says, do something about this. But what's so fascinating is what Jesus says is, look, it's not my time. It's not my time to reveal myself. And theologically, what this means is that from the beginning of the world, God had planned a time to which reveal himself to the world in Christian theology. And the fear of not having enough wine at the end of the night was so important that God changed the destiny of human divine relations so that people who were already drunk at the end of the wedding would not forgo wine at the end of the wedding. And so Jesus becomes our most famous winemaker. Mm-hmm. Non-traditional, for sure, but he is the most famous winemaker in human history, and he did so in order to create that hospitality that is so essential to so many religions, mm-hmm. that he took this, like, hey, this is a festive time. Wine is a part of that. And when his mother finally convinces him to do it, he says, okay. And that was the beginning of his ministry. So his ministry begins with the turning water into wine, and it ends. The last thing he says to his disciples is, drink wine in remembrance of me. The story of wine bookends the Jesus story. And in each case, it's a symbol of blessing and hospitality and connection to divinity.
And so you said that each religious tradition has some element of wine in their story. How do you think that translates into each, the sharing of wine, you know, during the service?
Yeah, so it's particularly Judaism and Christianity. Mm-hmm. Asia didn't have any grapes that had enough sugar content to reliably turn into wine. So you do see rice wine and some other things in China and Japan. But in almost all the traditions, hospitality becomes a central moment.
Did people in some way begin seeking out traditional religious connections then for the community? I mean, because you keep kind of going back to that. Was that the central piece, a place for people to gather and be safe?
Yeah, I mean, I think religion plays many roles in a society, one of which is to create connections between each other. And if you think, you know, to go back to hospitality for a second, you know, one of the things that a lot of religion has is gift giving. You know, we give gifts on Christmas or Hanukkah or birthdays or whatever. And when you think of the – when religious studies scholars look at gift giving, there's a lot of reasons why you do that. You know, economists will say, or you're transferring goods and all this sort of stuff. But so much of a gift giving is about communicating things that get awkward otherwise. So how do you tell your niece that you really love your niece? Mm-hmm. You think, what do they want for a holiday? You know, what would they care about? And you take the time to go find that thing. And what are you doing? You're communicating to that person, I care about you and I want to support this. Why, if you just, throw down a gift card, you're communicating, I feel obligated to give you something, but I don't care. Well, in the same way, the ritual of bringing wine to a dinner party, that's the plays that same function. We communicate to our hosts with the wine we bring. So if we bring a two-buck chuck that we just picked up along the way, we're saying, I feel obligated to bring something. I know that, but here's something. Mm-hmm. If we bring a wine that's meaningful to us, like, hey, here's a wine that Amy and I shared, at our anniversary, or here's a wine that we discovered, on a trip to Oregon, we wanted to share it with you. We're opening a part of ourselves to the host, and we're communicating to the host that we care about you. And so this seemingly innocuous thing, bring a bottle of wine to a party, becomes a means of social communication in the same way that religions have had mechanisms for doing that as well. And so many other things are like that. Like, in all your work in psychology, you realize that, boy, figuring out how to communicate with each other on deep issues is a difficult thing. And you have said all the time in our conversations, you hate the small talk. Let's get to the meaningful things.
Absolutely.
Well, I think this is one of the roles that toasting plays. Oh. Because if you're at a party and, the kind of pre-toast is, what's going on with the weather? How are things going on? Good, good, great. And then you give a toast. And the toast can mean a pro forma, let's move to the next thing, but oftentimes it's like, to my dearest of all friends. Things that are awkward, like, I don't go, hey, you're my closest friend. But in a toast, you can say that sort of thing. And then in most environments, post-toast conversation is where you really begin to talk. And it becomes a social signal to be, hey, now is the time to have the real conversations. And so when we start being aware of the different things, in this case, wine rituals play, we see how they contribute to the things that matter in our lives, having these deep conversations, sharing with each other, among other roles for religion.
My guest is Dr. Stephen Lloyd Moffitt, and we're talking about the spirit of wine and wine as a religious tradition. And as you're talking, I was thinking, what is the connection then to the abundance of wine options, everything from two-buck chuck to, a bottle from 1972, and all of the churches that pop up, kind of like renovate, and then all of, the proliferation of church options. Is there a connection between the not validity, but maybe the depth of those two things?
Yeah, I think there's a marketplace in spirituality, and there's a marketplace, obviously, in consumer goods. And so, in a place like SLO, there is religious options. And those options options evolve to the needs. So take Renovate, for example. It's First Baptist, 100 years or something like that. Over time, they realize that, hey, people don't like to be connected to institutions. Their leadership was not connected with the Baptist church. They evolve into Renovate and, sort of reshape their message. I would say probably their purpose is the same, to transform lives, but they've evolved their message. In the same way, people connect to different things in wine. I mean, for some people, I think, you might find Pinot as a particularly incredible vehicle to explore. Other people are more polytheistic. They'll kind of go with any tradition. But for some people too, what's fascinating about wine is the physical taste of wine shifts by your mental perceptions going into it. So they've done studies of putting people under CAT scans and they give them a wine and then they will say, oh, the next wine is a $200 wine and it's the same wine. But what's fascinating is the dopamine and the endorphins in their receptors and stuff, they all shoot before the wine even tastes it. And so the wine physically tastes different to you.
You're anticipated.
The anticipation. Yes. And what's fascinating is why I haven't seen a CAT, a brain scan study of this, but Amy and I are convinced that, when we know the winemaker, it changes it for us. And so, one of the things that I talk about a lot when I'm speaking with wineries is they need to see their wine club more as churches than wine distribution networks. They're people mm-hmm. who get together, and they go because they share a common love and passion. But they feel connected to each other and to the winemaker, to the family who owns the winery the winemaker. And they're creating this experience in the same way you go to a church because you feel connected to the people and to the minister who leads you mm-hmm. in it. And so you see it in that sort of way. And so when
it's almost like a common language that forms mm-hmm. around the wine. It yeah. gives you a starting place of we share this in common so we can start building.
Yeah, and so like if you're a member of Sausalito Canyon, wonderful winery just up the road, you're connected not just to their wines, which are great wines, but you're connected to the Greenough family, the family who are there and their son, the winemaker. But you're also connected to that staff in the tasting room, which at that winery has not changed in like 10 years, and they are family. Everybody comes in and they're there as much for the people pouring the wine as the wines. And the wines are great, but what they've created is a community mm-hmm. and that community brings meaning into their life. And every once in a while, you have, you know, one of their wonderful zins and it brings wonder into your life and mystery into your life and transcendence and maybe even a mystical experience. But in the same way as, you know, religious communities, so much of it is about that ancillary stuff, the connection with others, the depth of relationships that you can form through traditions.
But is there a danger then in the corporatization of wine that it loses its spiritual essence?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I point out is that, you know, if you're a winery that heavily manipulates the wine, it's sort of ripping the spirit out of the wine, mm-hmm. because a wine has to have a connection to the earth. I think that's kind of the mechanism by which a lot of this depth can happen. I think if it's about marketing, if it is about materialism, you know, wine can just be pure hedonism. And I'm not saying there's not a role for that. I mean, having a fantastic rosé on the afternoon, it's great. It's a nice porch pounder. It's a good time. That's fine. But I don't think all wines have the potential to create that depth of spirituality. And when you look at French wines, historically speaking, Burgundy has always been the spiritual element, and Bordeaux has been the hedonistic side. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a Bordeaux chateaus where everybody's in a sport coat and a tie and
dressing for church.
Yeah, and when Burgundy, it's the farmer. Mm-hmm. That's the face of it. That connection to the monastic tradition mm-hmm. that goes back.
So the more simple dressing.
Yeah,
for
yeah, yeah, or more earthly spirituality.
Yes,
I think. And I think, you know, a lot of, you know, it's very hard to find a spiritual connection to a $3.99 wine that just says Red California. But it's much easier to sit there and say, Amy and I had this amazing wine last week, Kukla up in Paso Robles. We drink a lot of wine, and it was a transcendent experience. And, you know, it was at Trilogy. We had it, the great restaurant at Trilogy there, but, you know,
not what we were expecting to have that experience.
We were expecting to have this great wine. And Kevin, the owner and winemaker up at Kukla, you walk in and you just never know when that's going to happen, mm-hmm. right? It was a gift from a student, adult student, and you know, we just brought it to dinner, and you have this unexpected moment of transcendence in your life, mm-hmm. and when you're sharing it with someone you love, that's magical moments right there.
Amy comes up in the conversation a lot, so we will say she is someone you love.
Yeah, yes. She's my partner.
Yes. My guest is Dr. Stephen Lloyd Moffatt. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. And clearly we're talking about the spirit of wine and how do we find those transcendent experiences in our day-to-day life around something like wine, whose history is deep in our world. You're listening to Central Coast Radio, Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. We'll be back in a moment to open the phone lines and take your calls.
God has the right to decide who's to live and die. He gave us sweet cherry wine.
This is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. Our number is 805-781-3875. My guest is Dr. Stephen Lloyd Moffitt. Stephen, can we talk about the mysticism piece, and that you talked earlier in the show about that conversion moment where you had that drink of wine. Try to explain that again to me, how people can have that experience.
Yeah. Well, so I did all these interviews around the world, and among them were in Burgundy. And one of my favorite interviews was with an eighth generation winemaker, and she's around my age. And we did this beautiful interview down in a cave, you know, where her family's wines have been. And as it happens, and we've talked about this, you know, the minute I turn off my recorder, we are kind of ending the conversation. She grabs me on the arm and says, "Steve, when people realize that wine is more than alcohol, it will be a bigger step for humanity than going to the moon." Wow. And I was like, what are you talking about? You know, what does that mean?
Yeah.
And I sort of, you know, chewed on that for a long time, thinking about what is he saying? And it's this idea that very few things in life bring us beyond our terrestrial view. That is, you know, so much of what we're doing is, oh, I've got to get the laundry. I need to get, you know, food. I need to do these sort of
the mundane
things.
Yeah.
And we go through life, you know, well, when we concentrate on the things that we need to do. But those experiences that we have every once in a while that make us sit down and just stop and say, there's something bigger than me in the universe. There's some reason why I'm here that I may never have thought of before. Those experiences are rare in our lives, and wine can do that to people. And I think that's the link to conversion, that, you know, when you're lucky enough to have one of those experiences, you now know the potential of wine to lead you beyond yourself.
That you can return to in some
way? Yeah, you can return to it. You can you can remember that hey, there's something more than dishes and laundry at this point. And I'm never quite sure what that is.
Right, because can you intentionally have a converting experience or a transcendent experience, or is it always a mystery which glass of wine or which experience is transcendent?
Yeah, well, I think it's always a mystery. And one of the fascinating things about wine is wine's alive. Right. What we do when we make wine is we take the grapes, we turn it into alcohol, and then we stop its slow path to vinegar. And as we're, you know, during that period between, you know, fermentation and vinegar, it is transforming. It has a human characteristics. We even talk about young wine being brash like humans, and then it's in the prime of its life, and then it's on the tail end, and it begins to smell a little, and it loses its vivacity. And so when you have a wine in your cellar, I think it's very appropriate that you can never actually, you know, it's in a dark green bottle, because you can never be fully aware of what's inside and the capabilities within it, because a wine will taste different on a Monday from a Wednesday, not just because you're different, which certainly you are. Your palate is shifted based on what you've eaten, you know, the biochemistry of your mouth and all sorts of things like that, but also because the wine is responding to its slow evolution to vinegar, to small bits of oxygen coming in, but also things like the pressures, you know, the pressures from the moon, and there's been all sorts of studies on biodynamics and stuff like that. And so you can never fully prepare yourself for the kind of experience you have. Mm-hmm. I did a wonderful interview with one of the most famous importers in Burgundy, an English guy who's lived there for 35 years, tasted the best wines in the world. I mean, done 100-year-old Domaine Romani Conti, which is the most expensive wine in the world. You know, did many, many bottles. And I asked him, you know, how do you decide what to drink? You know,
yes,
you've had all this stuff. And he says, you know, the most meaningful wines in the last 30 years for me has not been at these fancy tastings. It's been at 3 o'clock in the afternoon on a rainy winter day, and my wife and I are frustrated, and we walk down and we pick up a bottle, and we drink a whole bottle, the two of us, in the afternoon. He goes, those are the most meaningful wine moments. Mm. And it's unexpected. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a lesson in so much of life, is that if you try to force things to happen, they often are disappointing.
And it's not just wine, as you also said at the beginning of the show, that spiritual experience can happen in surfing.
Yeah.
Or other places.
Yeah, there's so many things. I mean, I think surfing works really well because my students often, because they have to actually, in the class I'm in right now, they have to develop a whole implicit religion, a non-traditional religion, and people talk about surfing in that way. And there's so many of the similar elements because, I'm not a surfer, but they'll talk about the camaraderie of all just sitting on your board waiting for that magical moment. And you never know when it's going to come. You're like, oh, this could be something good, and it's setting up well, and it's a disappointment. And then just when you're about to get out of the water, that wave comes, and you've shared it with other people, right? Mm-hmm. So you have that deep connection over something. And in the meantime, you are connecting to nature and connecting to other people. And so a lot of the ancillary elements of religion play a role there. Hiking is the same way. You know, you're hiking, and it's a foggy day in Big Sur, and, it's fun. You've got your friends, but then you go over a vista, and a ray of light comes in, and it's like you know mm-hmm. that's going to be a moment that'll be indelible in your life, and you're trying to make sense of it. You're trying to process it, and that can be with wine, with hiking, with surfing, and certainly in traditional religions too. Mm-hmm. You go to church or synagogue or temple for a year, and it's good, bad. There's someone, but every once in a while, something touches you, and it may not touch the person next to you, but for whatever reason, the stars conspired for that moment to be meaningful for you, and seize those.
So then, if someone wants to intentionally look at the spiritual side of a practice that they have, whether it's surfing or wine drinking, what are the elements? Because, when you go to church, it has the format.
It's prescribed for you.
Yes. So how do you create that sacred experience?
Yeah. Well, with wine, I actually go through 5 steps to do
in the book.
In the book, yes. So, buy the book and you can have a step to doing so. But I think if you need to lay out what you hope to get out of a spiritual life. And people will weight different elements in varying degrees. For some people, it will be connection to others more than transcendent experiences. For other people, it will be a guide to moral decisions. Mm. For other people, it will be a opening to mystery and wonder in their life. There's different elements. But then think through, how can this alternative pathway fulfill some of those needs in my life, and how can I make myself aware of it? Because I think humans tend to gravitate towards means that fulfill what we want. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of them are right there, whether it's, a fist bump before going in the water, whether it is a picture before a hike, mm-hmm. Hugging. Like there's different things
that we're marking
moments with, and we're finding the depth in the things we do. And so just being aware of that and bringing intention to those activities, and to realize and really give yourself permission to allow that to be your spiritual vehicle. Because I think a lot of people are racked in. It's like, oh, I really should be at church today. I really should be doing this. My grandma's going to be unhappy when she hears I haven't been. And like you've had an incredibly spiritual week, even if you didn't walk through, traditional religious buildings. Mm-hmm. And so, it's okay to forge your own path in it. There are different sets of challenges, right? You don't bring the institutional baggage that certain religions do, but you also you're not bequeathed the gifts from the past that I've given. You don't have hymns, you don't have theology,
right.
You don't have these things. So
that foundation.
Story, huh? So there's different challenges on each pathway going forward. But what I hope and what I kind of realized as this book evolved was to say, look. If you want something like wine to be your religion, that's okay. Own it. Do it well. Do it. Bring meaning into it. Drink monastically. Share your hospitality with others. Find mystery in it. And as you do, share it with others. Because the worst situation is the people who are so bitter towards religion and still carry the spiritual impulses in them, mm-hmm. and that just leads to frustration in their life.
Well, is that also maybe a path to why we start to numb ourselves with excessive drinking or excessive exercise or anything to fill that hole we're not quite sure?
Yeah, I mean, I think there is a sort of there's a need. That we have impulses. Many people do. I'm not sure if all people do.
But a spiritual impulse?
Yeah.
You don't think all people have? Because we talk as if every person.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Okay. I think it's to certain degrees. There's actually been a lot of genetic studies that suggest that we may actually be genetically some people more genetically predisposed to seeking out spiritual experiences. But I do think that if you're one of those who has that, the worst thing you can do is live a frustrated existence because you just can't walk through those church doors or those synagogue doors or I just can't sit down in meditation in a peaceful way. So explore, find the things that are meaningful to you and allow them to fulfill your spiritual needs.
Is yoga a spiritual tradition?
Yeah. It's the history of yoga is very complicated. My colleague Anya Foxen at Cal Poly is sort of the world authority on the origins of yoga. But even if it's not sort of an ancient Indian tradition, which it's not in the way we practice it today, it's become a modern way of integrating our lives, both exercise and spirituality and health. Mm-hmm. And so, hey, yoga is a wonderful spiritual vehicle.
The community
around it. Yeah. So it's great.
My guest is Dr. Stephen Lloyd Moffitt, and we're talking about his book, The Spirit of Wine, Finding Religion in the Fruit of the Vine. Alice, you're on the air. What's on your mind today?
Hi. Three things. Interesting discussion that you're having. In my spiritual tradition, I go to St. Benedict's Episcopal Church in Los Osos. As we gather with bread and wine, we always understand that we're not just there for ourselves or even that community, but to go out into the world and do justice. We are very active with the homeless and with the environment. So I'm wondering if any of that plays into the wine kind of spirituality. Second thing is, when I drive up 101 and I see hundreds of acres of land bulldozed and oak trees gone, I don't have a beautiful perception of vineyards. And last, I'm wondering if there's a wealth gap here. Mm. It's one thing to get $2 chuck, but another to have the incredible wine. So those are my three concerns, and I thank you.
Thank you, and we'll try to address all three.
Yes, Alice, great. And I love tell Reverend Caro hello. That's a wonderful community, the Episcopal Church in Los Osos. I do think if I can bring the first two together, that a true spiritual appreciation for wine is predicated on the realization that it is the blood of the earth. It is the connection to the soil. And so it saddens me to see the massive corporate farms up there. But, some of the most responsible farmers are vineyards. And the way they can connect to the land and to the oaks around it can be a way of really finding spirituality in the earth. And so, yes, there are incredible degradation of the world as we want to consume an incredible amount of goods. But I find hope in the fact that so many vineyards are realize that it's the care for the earth that allows them to express to express their character and share the earth with others.
And in our last, we only have a minute or so to go. What about the wealth gap piece?
Yeah.
Can you find transcendence in a two-buck chuck?
Yeah, I think more than the price of the wine, there is this sort of myth that expensive wine's good and cheap wine's bad. I think maybe on par, that's true, but there are wonderful inexpensive wines too, and there are horrible expensive wines. And so I would say that if a lot of wines are out of your reach, don't break the bank thinking you're going to have it. Instead, find the local wineries that you can build connections with, because you can buy a $10 bottle of wine or $15 bottle of wine and have a deep connection to the place and the people. You don't need to spend $100 on a bottle of wine. And I think particularly once you get above a level, the correlation between quality and price is pretty precarious. And so I think it's about how you contemplate the wines you drink. Are you wanting to find a wine that makes you look good in other people's eyes? Or are you trying to find the things that allow us to allows wine to be spiritual? Things like connection to others, connection to earth, and connection to mystery.
My guest has been Dr. Stephen Lloyd Moffatt, The Spirit of Wine, Finding Religion in the Fruit of the Vine. How do people find your book?
The easiest is on Amazon. Okay. Amazon, Spirit of Wine, or spiritofwinebooks.com is another one. On Instagram, it's called The Spirit of Wine as well. Those are all sources. Also in a lot of local wineries. And so Signer La Valle and Sausalito, Tambor, a lot of the wineries are carrying it, and we do workshops, my partner Amy and I, where we'll talk about how to make wine spiritual and then do some hands-on spiritual drinking.
So you might be the minister of the local wineries.
It could be a guide.
A guide.
Let's say.
Thank you so much for coming in and sharing this. As always, I appreciate all of our listeners, your participation. You can follow us on Instagram, find us on Facebook, listen to previous shows at kcbx.org, and podcast if you'd like to keep up with all the shows. Thank you for supporting Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.